Welcome to another episode of Blood, Sweat and Fears, the ultimate podcast for athletes talking about their physical and emotional journeys before, during and after elite sport. I'm Mark Clement, alongside me Scott Ward, a retired professional footballer and the man behind this podcast and EY's personal performance program. And on this particular episode, we are going for gold in spectacular style. It's a rowing special, and by my maths, I reckon we have the winners of 24 gold medals sitting around this table with us. 6 Olympic and 18 World Championships. Now, if I tell you that Scott and I have won none of them, you will get an idea about the calibre of our guests on this episode of Blood, Sweat and Fears. Back with us, EY's team lead for athlete care and development for the personal performance programme and winner of 2 World Championship golds, an Olympic gold in Beijing in 2008, silver in London 2012, legend Mark Hunter. I've had to put that title and prefix in because our other two guests have got equally impressive forenames, if you like. Next up, Team GB's most decorated female Olympian, silvers in 2000, 2004, 2008, 2016, with a gold at London 2012 in amongst them, and 6 times world champion. She's now chair of UK Sport, Dame Catherine Granger, and the granddaddy of them all, Sir Matthew Pinson. It would have been daddy a few years ago, but it's what, 15 years since you picked up the oars?
Yeah.
So, you know, times move on and things. 10 times world champion, 4 times Olympic gold medal winner. Right, I need absolute honesty in the answering of this. This question is not going to work unless you're absolutely truthful. On a day-to-day basis, emotionally, as you walk around the streets, buying your bag of reduced spinach from Tesco's or waving at your granny or whatever you do, I'm not talking physically, where have you parked your gold medals? Where do you see them? Where do you carry them? Are they with you all the time? I'm looking at you, Dame Catherine.
You are. Just on an emotional level, where are they?
Yeah, I don't mean like they're in my
where
sock
they physically?
Drawer.
Yeah, exactly. I don't
but
mean
I mean, where
are you? Nicking them.
Are you? I mean, because
I'm not consciously aware of them every day. I'm not. I think the
honestly,
life's too busy. I don't get to sit and reminisce daily. I think what they are, they'll always be a part of me and who I've become, but I'm not consciously aware of them or those achievements every day, no.
You get reminded of them a lot by the general public?
Yes, I do.
In fairness, I'm not surprised.
I get, I've literally, it's not every day, but I've literally got them in my bag today because I was doing a speech this morning, and when they're a sort of good icebreaker to any speech or school assembly or prize giving. So physically they're around me a lot, but on an emotional level, no, it's a chapter of my life, and that was then and this is now.
It doesn't make you puff your chest out and think, I'm having a bad day, so I feel, but look what I achieved in the past, I feel a bit special.
They're not a solution to a bad day, but I suppose the difference between in the CV section, you talk about world championships and Olympics. I don't even put them in the same category. Definitely not. Because Olympics are, even in isolation, life changing. It's a life changing experience to win one. Mm. And that's very, very difficult to unpick what's happened because of that and what would have happened if that hadn't happened. If the result had been the other way, if it had been a silver on that day and blah, 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 blah. But it absolutely is life-changing, yeah. Mm.
But hence my question, because when you are on top of the world, you are the number, what's the population of the world these days? About 7 billion, isn't it? So at that point, when you won your gold medal, in your discipline, you are standing on the pinnacle of the world. How can that not be with you all the time?
Yeah, to be honest, you never really think about it like that, though. You know, it is strange. You never think about, oh, I'm the best in the world. You never sit down and think, well, I didn't personally. That's what other people tell you. Because I remember when I won in Beijing and I moved to America, it was there, but I didn't walk around like saying I'm number one.
No.
Other people would enjoy that experience of telling people, oh, this guy's done this or this person's done that. But you never see it in that way that you just described it, because it's a personal journey to you to achieve that. And when you accomplish it, you tend to reflect on, well, I did anyway, how much time it took to get there. And I remember when we
did achieve it. Which makes it even more special.
Yeah.
But I still remember the first time, and you're right, I agree with you, Mark, in that it takes someone else to point it out. And the first time I won a world championship title, the first interview we did was a radio interview. And the first question was, how does it feel to be the best in the world at what you do? And it was in, you know, now you sit back, what an obvious question. At the time, as an athlete in the boat, and we were still physically sitting in the boat when they leaned across the water and asked that question. And it was that shock for both of us in the boat, thinking, God, that's what it means. And yet for years we'd been aiming for that. But for someone actually to point out you are now the best in the world at that still came as a bit of a surprise, because that's not what you're relating to it day to day.
Do you think, so before Mark and I met, I'd met numerous rowers, and those that had won gold at Olympics, for example, seemed to be fulfilled and can call a day on their career. Do you think that realisation that they became, after people had told them several times that they became the best in the world, was enough for them to say, OK, I've reached the pinnacle, what's next? Because there seems to be a very clear divide for me from those that I've spoken to from rowing and those in other sports. Because in other sports, there's always seems to be a what's next or a what if. But it seems like that defining moment allows somebody to break away happily and try to progress beyond the world of elite rowing.
But I think that comes from there being an obvious moment. You know, rowing in a sense is lucky because it's part of the Olympic family, and therefore that 6-minute race or whatever it is on that day in 4 years, that is going to be the end of that chapter and the end of that journey, and then you get a chance to restock and go again or not. Whereas in lots of other sports, and I think it's probably harder if you don't have an Olympic, you know, sort of moment. It would be hard in rugby or football, you know, unless you're going to win the World Cup, unless you're the right age. There's always going to be something else. There's always going to be something, oh, I'll just keep going for the, you know, and look at boxing. All of them go on too long until you have to live the downside of the hill as well as the climbing up. Whereas I think in Olympic sport, there is a sort of natural progression and a sort of drumbeat to it, which is after every games, everybody takes a pause and goes, right, now do I want to do that again, or do I want to attempt that again, or do I want to win again, or do I want to try and win again, or whatever it might be. And that's and so you every 4 years you've got to have a sort of time check.
Because I remember after we won in Beijing, I remember getting back to our room, obviously we are the champions playing and celebrating, and then I had a moment where everybody kind of left and I just sat there on the end of my bed. And I know it sounds
I don't like where this is going.
It kind of hit me, okay, you've achieved it. And I remember sitting there thinking about, like, you know, obviously Steve won 5, you won 4. And I was like, how the hell did these guys do that many times? Because you know what's going to happen with the physical exertion to do what you did, the mental side, the emotional side is something I always talk about that you can't prepare for. And I remember just sitting there going, how the hell do you do this time and time again?
And that's not uncommon that people have that sort of roller coaster ride, because the image of winning, especially in Olympics, is, oh, you jump into cloud 9 and you stay there forever. And like, it's just, you know, oh, it's life changing. And oh, it's going to be the most amazing feeling. And you're the best in the world at what you do. And you're number one. And whatever. And then the next feeling is, and I did exactly the same in 92, sat on the end of my bed, had a shower, went back to the village, had a shower, sat on the end of my bed with my medal in my hand and thought, well, that's it then. There it is. And then you think, well, this is supposed to be the best feeling ever, best day of my life, and you can't get better than this. And so the next sensation is, well, hang on, if today's the best day of my life, what's tomorrow? And what's the next day? And there, and you get this really strange roller coaster where at one moment you're feeling absolutely on cloud 9 and loving it. And then other times you're thinking, I've got no idea what I'm doing. I've got no plan. I've got no structure. I'll go out and have a party and drink some beers, and I'll be able to hang out with my mates for a while, but this isn't going to last forever. And you just go into a very strange sort of mindset.
Can that contribute to you signing up for the next cycle then? Because if you have that moment of fulfillment and then that those moments of uncertainty, because it's not a moment, is it? It's moments of uncertainty. Do you think, and I'm going to be really direct here, do you think a moment of desperation can almost put you into that next cycle in trying to get that same adulation, as opposed to it being the right decision?
Yeah, I think lots of people decide they want to carry on because they don't know what else to do.
Yeah.
Definitely. And I'm actually quite jealous of people that, you know, I won at 21, and there are a few guys and girls that we've rode with over the years, shared teams with, who won a gold medal. Yeah. See ya. Gone. And next, they're working in such and such, and they're doing a, you know, great job, and you're still slogging along. And you think, oh, actually, I wouldn't mind a 5-day week and a pay packet and a, you know, a pension and a weekends off and all the rest of it. And then it's like, well, no, I've signed up to do this. I'm quite jealous of that decision that made it quick, clean. They achieved absolutely what they wanted to do, and then.
Did you ever have the option to take a year out or anything like that, Matt? Was that something that ever crossed your mind to take time off?
Not early on, because, well, I mean, when I won with Steve in 92, I was 21. And it was like that. We were probably only going really quick in that boat for about a year running out. I mean, a year, but it was on song for a year running up to the games. And during that year, we were saying to each other, let's just keep this going. No one's going to touch us. This is, you know, like, we've got a good chance of winning the Olympics next year. Let's keep going. And so we'd almost said to each other, whatever happens in Barcelona, even if we muck this up, let's keep. And it was, what else, at 21, what else was I going to do? Everyone else was, you know, at uni, coming out of finals and going to wine and cheese evenings with accountancy firms and law firms. And you were like, really? I'm not. What are you doing? I'm off rowing, mate. Cheers. You know, that felt, at 21, that was a complete no-brainer. Definitely didn't have a second thought. Later on, then I thought, I wouldn't mind a year out. But then at 26 or 30, a year out would have been, okay, I might enjoy my year out so much, I might not get back.
Because this is, I gather, we both experienced that, didn't we? I had a year out after Beijing, but I'd actually decided to stop, went away for a year to California, coached. Then I started to think about why I started the sport and the fun element, because as an elite athlete, you know, that fun element we start with and the ambition we have, because it becomes your livelihood, your job, the expectation you have on yourself and the pressure, you sometimes forget the core essential why you started it. And I got to experience, actually, I'm watching other people develop at UCLA, and I was like, wow, they're really enjoying this. And that's a bit that I've kind of forgotten about. And that made me want to come back, because it was home games. And then obviously you had your time out after London. How did that feel for you, like, mentally refreshing? Was that what made you want to come back again?
Yeah, it wasn't a conscious decision to stop and retire or to stop and have a break. I really didn't know what I was going to do. And I think a lot of athletes at the 2012 Home Olympics for the British team were, you know, it wasn't a different scale than anything we'd experienced before. You know, the interest and the speculation and the celebrations afterwards were just on a whole different level. So it was very unreal world you stepped into in the weeks and months following 2012. And I think it was hard for anyone to adjust quickly back to normal life. So I was also, I was in the final year of my PhD, and I really wanted to finally finish that. I was genuinely coming to a deadline where they would have kicked me out forever. So I sort of felt, I'll take the time out, finish that, and also just decide what I want to do. And I was sort of very open to the fact that in this year out, but like Matt was saying, you other things exist out in the real world, and other people are doing things, and this is quite exciting.
Bank holiday weekends are a thing.
Honestly, even now, I love a bank holiday weekend. Such a novelty. So I was like, oh my goodness, I'll just be, you know, seized by all these amazing, exciting new thoughts and opportunities and ideas. And in that time, I was so lucky, I'd never fallen out of love with my sport in any way in all the years I'd done it. But having stepped out for a while, whether temporary or permanently, it gives you that chance to remember how special it is and why it is such a actually joyful thing to do. As hard and challenging and demanding it is of you, it is very, very special time that will always be limited and will always be, you know, a kind of luxury to go in and be involved in. So it was a very proactive decision to go back into it. It wasn't, you know, we talked about sometimes you just rule on the next one, the next one, the next one, because what else would you do? Whereas to step out and go, no, actually, I could do other things, but actually that's what I really want to do. Of all the options, that's what I want to do. That, to me, was quite compelling.
But yours is the most fascinating because, obviously, you had silver, 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 and that is almost subhuman effort to get back in and just try and get it to goal. But then to do it at the home games, you must have been tempted to go, nah. I'm going to go and drink my beer. That's it. I'm
well,
done.
I did go and drink my beer and my gin and my wine. I drank a lot of celebratory moments. And I think, it was. And it was absolutely fairy tale. And I think I was very, very lucky. My medal was purely positive. I didn't have any kind of, was that it? Or, some people have a sense of the expectation is so immense when you actually achieve it. Is it kind of, was that it? Whereas in mine really was. I really felt kind of pure joy, and it was exceptional for that time. But I think it was more everyone else very much assumed, well, that would be it, because why would you? Why on earth would you continue now? What else is there to do? And I rode in the boat with Anna Watkins, and she'd retired, and there was no kind of obvious sort of challenge next. So I think probably a little bit of me was quite stubborn in that, why should everyone assume that that's it done? Because maybe it's not. And then the option of, going back again, it is. If you love something and it's a passion and you realise how special it is, it's very, for me, it wasn't the, come back and you're guaranteed to get a result. It was almost the fact that I'd set quite an impossible task now to come back and still try and be successful. The challenge of that was what drew me back rather than anything else.
Because I always think about when I did come back after a year, that time away, I just wanted to enjoy every moment because I knew this would be it. They wouldn't be able to go on any longer than London. That was going to be the kind of call-in done. And obviously you have your tough times, but I just remember just to enjoy every part, knowing that every camp I went to, potentially the last time I'd be going to that location or racing in that venue. And you just try and kind of suck it up, and just enjoy it. And I remember every time we got on the podium, I'd always say, just like, enjoy this because this, it may not go right. We might not get here again. And I know in London we didn't celebrate as much as we wanted to because I knew that was final. But I remember saying to young athletes, whenever you get on that podium, whatever medal it is, just enjoy it because you never know whether that will be the last time you get to experience that. And you never want to look back and say, oh, I wish I'd smiled. But then I kind of didn't listen to my own advice when I think about London.
But it's easy. I mean, especially when you're young, it's easy to get wrapped up in the occasion, isn't it? And you take things for granted and... retrospect is a fantastic tool if it is given to you at the time. And, I think the common theme here is that level of consciousness that we need to try and install into people so they can understand what's good and bad for them real time, instead of sitting here like we are now and looking back at the good old years. It is definitely a feasible thing. It's just allowing us as well as people in sport to know it's not coming as a consequence to performance. And you said yourself, Catherine, that stubbornness kicks in. That is a standardized tool in anyone that's going to perform at that type of level. So it's a given. So we shouldn't be thinking that that's going to come away because you understand that there are bank holidays, or you might enjoy your Christmas Day, for example, and actually have a drink on Christmas Day. It's how we can normalize that type of discussion with people that are running the sports to know, look, this isn't a risk. This is a positive movement. Let's do this and let's commit to it so that everybody feels a bit more relaxed as well. And clearly that at the same time is going to increase your performance levels anyway.
You've spent a decade studying this and building, a lot of the information that now is part of this programme. Do you think these emotionals are packageable? Is it possible to define it into a programme? And how important is it actually to manage success, reaching that pinnacle and knowing what to do afterwards?
Well, I think, we train, the guys around the table have been at the absolute pinnacle and are some, let's be honest, some of our best ever athletes. And we have packaged them to perform at that level. We can replicate that same outside of sport. I think again, it comes back to the language we choose and allowing people to be people from the young age that we're asked to commit to sport. From the research and from the work that Mark and I have been doing, it doesn't matter what athlete you speak to, whatever level they've performed at, they will always want to do the best. Now, clearly, there's always an element of realization on what the best looks like outside of sport. There's not a time to define yourself by or a league standing to do that. But it's allowing them to have their own point of realization. So I've spoken before on the previous podcast, when I had to stop football, I had no money, I became a dustman. My spot there, my target, my motivation was being really good on my round. And it sounds really, really pedantic, but I made sure that I was going to be the best bin puller in Harrow. And again, I know, you look back and you think, geez, sad times, as my daughter would say. But it wasn't, because at the time I was having fun. And so if we can install this opportunity of scope while you are becoming an athlete, it's only going to be for the betterment of yourself then and in the future. As I said, it's a really broad dialogue we have to start having, but the sooner we have it, the sooner it will become a reality. And these statistics and the long-term effect that people are having to go through will be diminished sooner or later.
Catherine, do you hear these conversations all the time with your current hat on, Chair of UK Sport?
Not all the time, because Chair of UK Sport encompasses a large variety of areas. So
oh, we'll come to that in a little while.
A lot of but it's more, the lovely thing is I still have a lot of connection. You know, I spend a lot of time within sports now, so I still make sure I catch up with athletes whenever I'm places. And I think the conversation is quite varied. I think there is, and it depends, like we've just said, it depends on where you are in your, you know, in your lifetime as an athlete. When you're starting off and you kind of feel it's this incredible journey you're about to embark on, then you aren't so concerned about whatever might happen next. And I think that's, you know, that's one of the things we're moving towards, is thinking it's never too early to think of what you might be doing either alongside your sport or after your sport. But certainly I think we're all the same at the start of our sport. Like Matt was talking about, when you're 21, you don't necessarily want to have your, you know, career ending strategy in place, because actually you've hopefully got decades ahead of you.
It's like a pension discussion.
Who wants a mortgage or pension at 21?
That's what you tell everyone at 18, start saving for your pension.
And that comes back to messaging, doesn't it? So we have to re-articulate that from a, if you like, a safe proof plan to, this will enhance your career while you're active, and this is what this will provide you while you're still an athlete. And I think it's that fear element, isn't it? It's like when you speak to your kids about trying to install something or tell them why it's good for them. You soften it and you make it absorbable for them. We just need to do that in a different way with the athletes. And as I said, it's definitely attainable. It's just it's definitely a bit of a cultural shift, isn't it, I think?
There's so many questions I could ask you, but if you look at the trajectory of those four medals, I mean, you must have changed enormously as a human being, clearly, you know.
Yeah.
Nearly half your life moved on over that period. I guess you had the peer pressure of Steve being two ahead of you. You went from maybe junior to senior, you then had to step out for the final one you got on your own. That's a heck of a lot of change to assimilate, Matthew.
Yeah, but that at the time, that gives it a different pattern, which makes it a different challenge. It's not repeating the same thing again and again. It wasn't a cookie cutter, and that's partly why Steve and I did two Olympics together in the pair. And then that was, the second one was Atlanta. And as I understood it, what he'd been telling me in the run-up to Atlanta was, this is it, I'm done. Four's plenty. Other things to do. Kids are growing up. Like, I'm done. And I was ready for that. And he was doing exactly what Mark was saying about going around the circuit on the last year, sort of saying goodbye to all the places on the circuit. And then he gave this really emphatic retirement speech about, I am done. If anyone sees me near a boat again, they can shoot me into a live TV camera, which at rowing in those days was really rare. It was like, wow, we're going to be live on TV. And then he went with Anne, his wife, and three children. He must have had three then, all three, went down to Florida to Disney on holiday. Didn't stay for the second part of the games. And I sort of waved him off and thought, right, what am I going to do now? And then I came back and started talking to our coach about a month later, saying, right, I want to go to Sydney. Who's around? Are you still coaching? What are we going to do? And he said, oh, have you spoken to Steve? I was like, what? No. I picked up the phone to Steve, and I said, Jürgen tells me you might be thinking about carrying on. And he said, yeah, I'm thinking about it. And I said, right, well, rule one, if we're going to carry on, we're not doing the pair anymore. Let's do the four. let's do something else. Let's build, because it had been 6 years together in a really close proximity in a really tight unit. And so that's how we hatched, you know, that gave us another dimension to then win a different class gold medal, a different boat class, for Sydney. So none of them are I look at them now and none of them are the same story again and again. And that keeps it interesting and challenging, whilst a lot of it is the same, of course.
And just for me, obviously being a kid, you know, I was on training camp for the Junior Worlds.
I've called him Grandad already. Don't start playing there.
Yeah, really? My kids are only 12.
So I remember we were on our Junior Worlds training camp, and I was competing in the quad at the time, and we sat there and watched you and Steve win in Atlanta. And then obviously coming back from the games, you were the only gold medalist GB had.
36th on the medal table.
Obviously, what we are now as a force to be reckoned with, basically. What was that like back then? Because obviously now people share information with UK Sport and the funding that came in. But back then, did people come to you guys to, how do you do this? Because you were the only gold medalist we had.
There was that, you guys know, but rowing is over on the middle weekend of the games. And back then, as we do now, there was a whiteboard in the Team GB headquarters in the bottom of the block with columns ready to be filled in, you know, and there was a big sort of moment filling in, oh, first gold medal, great, you know, and Steve had gone by then. So it was like I was sort of there for the, you know, the sticker of the gold medal to go up in that column. And then each day after that, I'd go in, and yeah, we were winning silvers and bronzes, of course. And then about halfway through that second week, I started thinking, what have we got left? What, you know, Linford didn't win the 100. There was I remember it as the 4x400 relay with the likes of Roger Black and Akabusi, I think, they were up against the Americans, but that was a solid chance to win. I remember, and being 4x4, it was our last one. And I sat and watched it in an American bar in Atlanta with a beer in my hand, no one else around me, and watched them win the silver. And then I thought, well, we're the only gold medal. And I was sort of stunned by the idea. And then, bluntly, I thought, well, this is great. This is great. We, or maybe even I, am going to be the only continuing gold medalist. We're going to have sponsorship. It's going to be brilliant. It's going to be on a different financial basis. This is going to be fantastic. It's good. Yeah, selfishly, it's good for us, good for me. And I came back and there was nothing. It was like I stepped off a plane, the Team GB flight, and there was a little posse of media people waiting at Heathrow. And there was me, Roger Black, Chris, Steve Backley, Javelin, and a couple of others. And we all stood there. And one of the media, so I'll ask the first question. Right, okay. How does it feel to be part of a disappointing British performance? Yeah. And I looked at everyone else and went, I'm not answering that one. I've got my gold medal. And that was the attitude. It was like it was seen as a disaster. No one wanted to talk about it. No one was interested in the Olympics. There was no hype. There was nothing. And it was like, actually, this has gone completely the other way. This is disastrous for Olympic sport. And it was only in the wake of that that the lottery began. It was almost that autumn, 96, that the lottery began to get going. And then suddenly this wave of funding and people and facilities, and that was a sea change. But it was bizarre to be part of it. I was doing radio interviews in the second week of the games with, like, I think I did one with almost with John Humphreys on the Today Show, being like, what's gone wrong? I was like, hang on, why am I answering this? But there was no administrators, though. There was no UK Sport to say, you know, we haven't done very well here. It was amazing. It was just a completely different... People don't remember it. Sport's personality that year was just bizarre.
It was like, a very different time, as you say, pre-lottery.
Yeah.
Did you, as athletes, see that dangle coming? Did you know about it well in advance? The lottery's going to come and there's going to be consequences for sport? Were you aware of it?
I think we knew in theory what was going to happen, but we didn't know in practice. We didn't know that, you know, for a sport like rowing, there was the possibility of an athlete getting a set amount of money. And back then, I'm going to struggle now. I reckon it was £12,000 or £15,000, an A grant, a proper, you know, medalist grant. And suddenly rowing had 40 or 50 people on grants. It was a squad where it was like, hang on, everyone can train full time. Whereas almost there'd been about half a dozen of us, Steve and myself included, running up to Atlanta training full time. And we had training camps with like six people. Because it was like, well, I can't get time off work. I can't come. All right, well, we'll go. Because we were sponsored a little bit. And then suddenly it was like night and day. It was like just turning on a switch. And the irony, and it's not nothing to do with, it's obviously it's not, you're not changing the individual talents of people. But we had people in the 80s and 90s, Olympic gold medal quality athletes, just gone, lost to the sport because they couldn't afford it. How are they going to train full time? How on earth are they going to afford to do this? And in fact, you know, 2000, we won 14 gold medals or something. And I would have reckoned, you know, we'd only won two or three if we hadn't had lottery money.
Before I wrap up this first part of our chat, I got to ask you, did you ever think about the risk as you continued to go for those medals, that you had this perfect Olympic record and you didn't want to kind of spoil the sequence? Did you ever get to a point to think, well, I've got three and it, you know, there's no guarantees I'll get a fourth? Did you ever think about it from that point of view?
A bit, yes. But by the time I was mid-20s, but after I'd won two, so I'm 26, got two gold medals. Hang on, I haven't got one. Yeah, 26 after Atlanta. And by that point, your CV is looking very odd indeed. I did a degree, but that was 3 or 4 years. And then, so you've got this very strange sensation of everyone else is busy. The education is only one little chapter of their CV, and they've got all these other jobs. And I had nothing else in the lower section. The logic was, do you know what? I might as well just go for this, because the longer I can keep this going, actually, it's not going to make a weird CV any weirder. The fact that you've done three games or four games or however many, and whether you win two, three, four medals or five, whatever you were aiming for, that's only going to get better. And so I don't know what else to do. It was back to the thing that the guys were saying about, it's a wonderful thing to do because you're very good at it. And even then I knew, do you know what, in my life, you'll be sort of one in a million if you find two things in your life that you're going to be the best in the world at. That would be amazing. Count yourself lucky you found one. And are you seriously thinking at the age of 26, you're going to say, bye-bye, I'm off to go and be whatever it would have been I would have gone and done. And so, no, it didn't feel like a risk at all. Because, you know, whether you win another medal or a different colour medal or, end up injured or something, that's just sport. It's not, that's a small factor in the decision.
Do you see it as a perfect career?
Ooh, it was close. 2003 was annoying.
Always. You lot are all the same. Even though on paper it just looks great and people would, you know, people around the world would look and go, wow, you'll still have those things that niggle you.
Because I was a young athlete.
That's the last reference to this, okay.
No, but I remember because I was in the room next to James and I remember watching that final when you're coming fourth, and I came back and he was sitting on his bed in his room, and I remember going in there and I was like, because he was at Leander, he was captain at the time, and I was like, are you okay, mate? He goes, it's all over. I was like, what do you mean it's all over? He goes, we're not going to win next year. And I was like, what do you mean not going to win next year? And just... like, to me, like, you were the two iconic figures in our team. And then he just opened up about being, it was like a human being rather than this superhero. And he just started talking about his vulnerabilities and how it was going to be tough. And I just remember sitting there just going, mate, you're the person that will turn this around. I'm pretty sure of that. You'll make this work. You guys know how to deliver on the day. This is the World Championships. And I always remember you saying the Olympics is for life. Mm-hmm. World Championships is every year. And I started just repeating stuff that you probably told him all the time. And he definitely won't remember that conversation. But I remember just sitting there like this iconic figure that I looked up to that would train hard on anybody else, was mentally tougher than anybody else. You know, just being vulnerable and just being open with what had just happened, because it was, it didn't just come forth. You hadn't won a medal, and it was like shockwaves across the team, wasn't it, when you think about it? And we just qualified. So I was ecstatic. We just qualified to go to the Olympics next year. And then you're talking about an iconic figure showing, you know, I keep going back to it, their kind of weakness and vulnerability, you know, that they are human. And that was really, you know, I think back to as I progressed, being able to be that open with younger athletes just to show that human side was really important.
So you think that molded your approach?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Just certain conversations, because when you're a young athlete and you're around your superheroes, you know, you just want to absorb information from them. You don't necessarily have to always talk to them. It's just being in the vicinity to see how they go about their jobs, what makes them so good at what they do. And I remember just watching people and just being in the same crew room, having coffees at Leander and just sitting there. And I was a sponge. That's what I looked at. I was a human sponge. Anything I could take and use to help me shape the way I wanted to be going forward. But yeah, that human side was really important, actually. It was really important.
Hold that thought, because we've got so much still to discuss in this special rowing edition of Blood, Sweat and Fears. So we are going to make this a two-parter. Thanks for listening so far. A reminder, for more information about the EY programme itself, please visit our website, ey.com/UK/personal-performance-programme. This podcast and future episodes in the Blood, Sweat and Fears series are available on iTunes and via the EY website by visiting ey.com/UK/PAS/podcast. For the time being then, thank you to Sir Matthew Pinsent, to Dame Catherine Granger, to legend Mark Hunter, and of course to Scott. I'm Mark Clement, brought to you by EY, building a better working world. Thanks for listening to the latest episode of Blood, Sweat and Fears, the ultimate podcast with a focus on athlete experiences, readiness and preparation for life in and out of sport. Goodbye for now. Look out for part 2.